Well, I need to say right off the bat that the subject this morning is not what's in the bulletin. It says rational preaching. I'm for rational preaching. I've had a couple of other kinds of pastors in my life, but the subject is relational preaching. I can't imagine how that happened, except perhaps when my secretary gave the title to Ken's secretary, they left the little E-L out between the R and the A. You theologians know what EL stands for. When you leave God out of things, you're inevitably in a mess. And so I would like you to focus on relational preaching, if you will, and not rational preaching. I want to say again, I keep bringing all my footnotes up of things I forgot to say the day before, that you can, of course, divorce the precept and the story. The truth is that we all are interested in getting precepts from lobe to lobe, from the lobe of the speaker to the lobe of the listener, and I believe that stories will lubricate the transfer. And that's basically what I'm speaking to you about. I believe there is a rather strong relational power in precept as there is in story. I want to talk to you about the relational power of story, but there are some relational powers in precept as well. I must confess, I'll talk about that in a moment, confessional preaching. In my very early days, I did use an overhead projector. I did, in those very early days of my ministry, try to be more of a Calvinist than I have later become, I'm afraid. I found, however, that preceptual preaching for me often became harsh. There's relational power in precept. When we stand to say the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, we are, in essence, repeating precepts together as a people. They're ideological precepts. Precepts that we often resent when we hear the ideologies of other kinds of governments, but they're often very, very harsh in their exercise. After these, my projector days were gone, I found myself in these latter times having a son-in-law who is a Calvinist, a Reformed pastor. And so our conversations have been very interesting. His pulpit style is very, very perceptual, as you would suspect. He endorses tulip Calvinism, and they rehearse those precepts together regularly in their fellowship. Nothing wrong with them, total depravity, unconditional election, limited atonement, irresistible grace, and perseverance. But I still like the idea of the Apostles' Creed, in which Christians for so many centuries now have really had a story confession, believing in the Father, in Jesus Christ, his Son, who was born of a virgin, who died under Pontius Pilate, who rose again from the dead, is seated at the right hand of the Father, from whence he shall come to judge the living and the dead. That is a story confession that has united strongly across 17 centuries or so. So I would say that conversion and martyrdom always, it seems to me, focus around the importance of the story. Conversion is an attempt to get people to change stories, to change scripts. Martyrdom is often comes as a result of not being able to give up that story. Precepts are very, very important. They are the skeletal systems upon which we hang the rest of faith. Precept and story, as I said yesterday, always come together in Scripture and really cannot be separated very far. They are the skeleton. But when I was taking anatomy back in college, I remember that we had in our classroom a skeleton whom we named Caroline. One of my fellow students was named Bonnie. Bonnie and Caroline had some things in common. Caroline had a hinged jaw. We could all always pull down her jaw, stick a cigarette in it. We often taped a rose to her skull. We played with her tibia sometimes. Bonnie was in the room with her, and I began to like Bonnie. I noticed a lot of things in common. I knew that underneath they were somewhat structurally alike. But I dated Bonnie. And perhaps that says enough about how I feel about the issue of precept and story. A decade ago, I threw out the... pulpit in my church. Two big deacons lugged it back in, saying that it had come from the MacArthur estate money and shouldn't be thrown out. So we compromised and put the pulpit in the basement of our church. It was a fearsome step for me, preaching without a pulpit, for some in our church said that pulpits should be there. They symbolized authority. I said that the Berlin Wall also symbolized authority. But I felt that throwing the pulpit out was a step in favor of relationalism. Maybe authority did suffer a little bit. John Stott has reminded us several times that when pulpits are in their place, preachers often stand tall, but they speak 8 foot above contradiction. And while authority may be there, something happens to relationalism in that instance. Ever and anon, we lug our pulpit back upstairs, put it in the sanctuary for some preacher who feels insecure without it and is speaking in our church on Sunday. But I was comforted recently when we hauled it back out of the basement that one of our little five-year-olds who couldn't remember ever seeing it pointed to it and said, "Daddy, what is that thing?" I felt good about that. I think that is the mark of a church that wants at least to emphasize relationship. Relationship's important. Fred Craddock said that Carl Sandburg was once asked what was the ugliest word in the English language. Sandburg, in the way he could do it, only repeated the question, the ugliest word, the ugliest word. He said it a third time, the very ugliest word. And then when he had every attention, he dropped quietly the egg into the nest and said, "Exclusive." The ugliest word is exclusive. The most beautiful word, I think, must be the word friend. It must be inclusive. It must be relationship. Relationalism in the pulpit is an imperative that the contemporary preacher dare not ignore. When every show on television, it seems, is a talk show, and every discussion is a panel discussion, the age declares psychologically and sociologically that we are hungry. Relationship is the all-important word. Scott Peck, in his new book, A Different Drum, examines community as the crying need of the 20th century. To learn in every organization has been superseded by our need to fit in. Students who used to want to be taught, you may have recognized as professors, now want you just to feel with them from time to time. Preaching must be a dialogue, therefore. The sermon as monologue, if it ever was monologue, is now dead. Eugene Peterson says we keep telling stories to locate ourselves in the human condition. Story binds us together. As a child, I liked the story of my grandmother Kent, whose first name was Sadie and whose middle name was Nebraska. "Why Nebraska?" I once asked her. "Because," she said, "I was born in Nebraska in 1882. We were on the way to settle somewhere west when my father turned south to Oklahoma. I love the simple story, though 1882 seemed a long ways from 1940. Whenever Grandma would come to visit us in northern Oklahoma, I wanted to hear that story again. And my grandmother would once more tell me how she came to be Sadie Nebraska Kent. Grandma died in 1951, and my mother would often talk about our prairie heritage. Again, she was born herself in Indian Territory, Oklahoma. In time, I grew up and returned to Nebraska as a pastor. I had children of my own, and they liked to hear the stories about their great-grandmother, Sadie Nebraska Kent. And, of course, I told them the story. Why tell the story at all? Because stories locate us in the human condition. Stories bind us to each other in the earth. Sadie Nebraska Kent helped me find my place in time and space. The stories of primitive nations are usually sagas of clans, for most nations are but single families grown large. At the beginning of Rome is a story of Romulus and Remus, the quarreling twins. At the beginning of the Anasazi Indian cultures of the Southwest in America is the emergence of life from the spirit womb of Sipapu. At the beginning of the Hebrew nation is the call of Abram and Sarai, his wife. Sometimes these stories are stories of a people which are true, sometimes they are mythic, but always they are the mortar of cultural relationships. And the accretions themselves intrigue us. Accretions interweave legend and history so that we cannot really tell them apart very good. Did Davy Crockett really kill a bear when he was only 3? Although I have seen vicious, unruly children in Baptist nurseries, I doubt it. Did Beowulf really dispatch Grendel's mother? Is half of what they say about Pendragon and Igraine of Tintagel true? Did Arthur really use the round table to invent Parliament or backgammon? It is hard to sort through the truth and to know. Such Genesis epics, like rolling snowballs, gain bulk as they are told and retold. I don't mean Genesis here as a book. I want to be very specific about this. You who are taping. I mean the beginning of stories, all right? Thus, different cultures celebrate their origins as they celebrate their uniqueness, marking and defining who we are as a people. It is true of Christianity as it would be for other religions. Once upon a time, Jesus is our story. Once upon a time, the cross. Once upon a time, the tomb. Once upon a time, Easter. Once upon a time, the greatest story ever told. We feel intently protective of our stories, as do other cultures. We feel our stories is the only one which matters, as do other cultures. We feel our stories cannot be saved unless we believe the story as true, as do other cultures. Ayn Rand said once that art is man defining himself. I remember one time in New Mexico backpacking a huge canvas to a particular mountain waterfall that I had always thought was lovely. My wife was backpacking with me and had taken a couple of books to read while I painted. I began to do a monochromatic study in blue and had determined to call it Blue Waterfall. I pictured it as being very beautiful in my mind. But the longer I painted, the more I despised my work. Finally, I decided that I would not have that horrible picture in my house or in any art show of my own. So I signed it Kris Kringle and left it leaning against a tree, hoping that it would not embarrass Santa Claus. It was a form of litter bugging, I know, and it may still be there, or some lowbrow may have backpacked it out to civilization again. And it may be on some nameless American wall embarrassing guests. I only know that I was not willing in any way for it to stand for my own self-definition. We tell stories as art forms that define who we are. We tell of Huck Finn and think of Mark Twain. We mention Billy Budd and we think of Herman Melville. Each of these stories are the definitions of their tellers. The stories that define nations are strong and well defended. Arthur defines primitive England. Miles Standish defines America. Jubilation T. Cornpone is the rallying saga of Dogpatch. I'm not sure that Eva Perón is the defining story of Argentina to Argentines, but every time I hear the song, Don't Cry for Me, Argentina, I want to cry for Argentina. And since I hardly ever cry for Bolivia or Paraguay, I suspect that the art of Andrew Lloyd Webber defines the nation for me, at least. Story becomes the definition and sometimes the hard definition. Stories draw lines of prejudice and sometimes hate. Men and women draw symbols of their stories, Christian crosses, Davidic stars, Muslim moons, Shinto suns. They march carrying their little stories and battle anthems and their imperial stories. They cry at every juncture, become a convert to our faith, tear down your altars, change stories, believe ours. It is often story loyalty that drives cultures apart. But the glory of living in a crowded world may at last teach us. Sheer numbers and international economics seem to be drawing us at last together. East is east and west is west, wrote Rudyard Kipling, and never the twain shall meet. Bruce Lockerbie says that Kipling was only right about east being east, for they do meet, he says, every day in the voice of America, in stereotypes, black-legged in Hong Kong or Bangkok or transcendental meditation in New York. Now they are meeting, and story serves to make the meeting amenable. Any numbers of stories have arisen. In the West, one of the big concerns of missiologists is how to take the Evangelium, a story that works well without its Western trappings, how to get Jesus out of the red, white, and blue of American missions and into the ochres and grays of the Third World hope. We're trying to make the story global in the hopes that in every world system, the preachers will still remain the primary storytellers. Phillips Brooks says that truth will always have to be communicated through personhood. So much depends upon the preacher as a storyteller. Tell the old, old story to the brave new world, and we must sharpen our skills to become the best of all possible raconteurs. Well, I am ready to leave the nation hemisphere implications of stories and consider the social mortar they provide on a smaller, more important, intimate identity scale. The late Grady Nutt was a story looking for a place to hatch. Some of my favorite memories of him I earned by staring into his toothy grin and listening to him spin yarns. Deep in his Southern Baroque style, there was ever truth, and Grady wisely claimed that to the storyteller belongs his or her art. I agree. A preacher's story, should never lie, unless in the telling of the lie. There is such excessive language and hyperbole that it clearly says, this is a lie, and I will tell it as though it is true so that we can both celebrate its fiction together. One feeds, for instance, on such hyperbole in the stories of the popular columnist Irma Bombeck. We know when she is lying, and she knows we know. But it is fun to enjoy her exaggeration together. To the raconteur belongs his or her craft. So there is no need to ask Garrison Keillor, is there really a Chatterbox Cafe? We know there is, and yet there isn't. There really isn't one in Lake Wobegon. There really isn't a Lake Wobegon. But there is a similar cafe to that in Hunter, Oklahoma, where I had my first church. And there is a Val Tollefson, Garrison Keillor's Lutheran deacon, who couldn't see spending a nickel of the church's money on ideas that weren't his own. I have met Val a dozen times in his many Baptist churches in business meetings. Stories are symbols of things we agree on. What about this symbol? Virginia, is there really a Santa Claus? I suspect that there is. Does he fly? Okay. Does he have elves? All right. In spite of the cancer label on tobacco, he, Santa, smokes. He clearly overeats, risking a double bypass to remain a chubby cultural symbol. As many Southern fundamentalists point out, Santa is a humanist who is big on welfare and the United Fund, but doubt Santa and be very open about it, and you will find yourself off a great many Christmas lists and onto a great many Halloween lists, including the entire cast of The Miracle of 34th Street. Symbols, fantasy, or legend mold us together. Consider Mark Twain or the delightful Yorkshire veterinarian James Herriot. They have devoted themselves to being very good at what few preachers take seriously enough. John Atkins said of Hemingway, "Writing well is difficult, but writing well is all he ever wanted to do." If we as pastors are going to spend our entire lives telling the old story, maybe we ought to develop our wit as storytellers. One last time I will deal with my adversaries. I know that there are those who say, keep away from stories, for stories fictionalize great truths. I believe the exact opposite is true. Stories concretize great truths. Stories keep a society sane. They do not lead it to fictionalize away the truth it contains. G.K. Chesterton wrote, "There's a notion adrift everywhere that imagination, especially mystical imagination, is dangerous to men's mental balance." Poets are commonly spoken of as psychologically unreliable. I can attest to that, I guarantee you. Most of the very great poets, he says, have not been only sane, but they have been extremely businesslike. And if Shakespeare ever really held the horses, it was because he was much the safest man to leave them with. Imagination does not breed insanity. Exactly what does breed insanity is reason. Poets do not go mad. Chess players do. So, in helping people to imagination, we may be helping them to mental health. I want to suggest to you in this lecture that one of the very important functions served by a preacher is out to become the best raconteur is that he is in the business of helping people relate to each other in the world. Nothing has greater force for relationalism than the story. It wells people into oneness with each other and with wholeness with their world. Stories pull interest into intensity. Stories fuse whole theaters full of people until they rise as one to their feet in roaring applause. They weep in muffled tears that can be heard from the boxes to the loge or the balcony. Stories pull on the interest of thousands of people until they are fused in focused relationship. The stories of our lives are part and parcel of someone else's story, so that any single story wells the whole together. As I consider the story, I consider again the powerful truth hidden in John Donne. No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. Any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind. And therefore, never sin to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. There are no independent stories. The words once upon a time say, get ready. We are going to relate. We all follow the same great once upon a time. What happens to you happens to me. Your pain is not one that hurts you only. It hurts all the world a little. Your absence and loss will diminish your world. You are God-made. You are divine and necessary to the redeeming of a lost world. I love my favorite American singer, Walt Whitman, but never more when he said, "For my enemy is dead. A man as divine as myself," said Whitman, "is dead." Was Whitman an egotist? I don't think he was an egotist at all. I think what he was saying is that he was a minister, and a minister who sang all his life. Paralyzed, by the way, for the last 30 years that he was alive, singing from a wheelchair. And make no mistake about it, you are from God. You're each unique. You uniquely tell a story that no one else can tell quietly like you to fuse your world in oneness. While my favorite theologians are, of course, teach at Southern Seminary, one of my next favorite theologians is Dr. Seuss, who said, "If you'd never been born, then what would you be? You might be a fish or a toad in a tree. You might be a doorknob or three baked potatoes. Or worse than all that, you might be a wasn't. A wasn't has no fun at all. No, he doesn't. A wasn't just isn't. He just isn't present. But you, you are you. Now, isn't that pleasant? Today, you are you. And it's truer than true that there's no one alive who is youer than you. Shout loud, I'm lucky to be what I am. Thank goodness I'm not just a clam or a ham or a dusty old jar of gooseberry jam. I am what I am, and it's a great thing to be. If I say so myself, happy birthday to me." Now, as I think of that, I think you are unique. There is no use in telling yourself that the story is unimportant to yourself. It is important to yourself and your world, and oh, you are important in the telling of that story. In Henry VI, the bloody War of Roses takes a piteous toll. It is not Lancaster who diminishes York. It is not York who diminishes Lancaster. It is Lancaster who kills Lancaster, and York, York. And a character called in the play by Shakespeare simply a son enters carrying the body of his father, whom he has mistakenly killed in this piteous conflict. And the son holding his father cries, "I who at his hand received my life, have by my hands of life bereaved him. Pardon me, God, for I knew not what I did, and pardon me, Father, for I knew not thee." And in the same bloody scene, a father who in the War of Roses has killed his son enters crying, "Ah, boy, if there be any life in thee, throw up thine eye now. See where showers arise, blown with the windy tempest of my heart. Thy father, which gave thee life too soon, hath bereft thee of thy life too late. Which was lost, father or son?" Well, the king says, "It is I who have lost." The king says, "Sad-hearted men, much overgrown with care, here sets a king more woeful than you all." You see how Shakespeare has caught John Donne's truth? Where there is great dying, it is pointless to ask for whom the bell tolls. They toll for all of us, kings and pawns alike. The world is one, and stories make it so. In the marvelous southwest of America, those wonderful Hopis and Navajos have artists who fashion not only pots, but here and there a ceramic icon called the storyteller. Here, clustered against the mammoth terracotta squaw, are 15 or 20 fire-glazed papooses, and the papooses are gathered with rapt attention, focused on the face of the storyteller. She brings the oneness. The word we Baptists have used so often to undergird our definition is koinonia. Hugh Womble impressed me years ago when he called Baptists the people of the fellowship. We are a groupie lot, and our stories are sometimes a toll to strengthen our prejudices, however. I recently lectured at a Methodist seminary. It was hard to go there. I thought they should all be modernists and unworthy of my deep devotion. But as I got there, I made many Methodist friends, and as far back as I can remember, Baptist stories had taught me Methodist prejudice. Even Methodists, it seemed to me, ever really preached or told stories like we wanted them to. Grandpa Young taught me much of it. He is now 99, and in the fall he will turn 100 years of age. Around 1900, Grandpa said, he began to notice liberal trends among the Methodists and the Camelites and the other two congregations in our community. And those Methodists, he said, sprinkled, and Camelites baptized upstream in the Salt Fork River, he said, letting the river current wash the dresses of the lady converts high enough to be lewd before the Lord. We Baptists, he said, baptized in a more godly manner downstream and were therefore more pleasing to the Lord. Further in the 30s, he said, the liberal Methodist farmers had become the first to work the fields on Sundays. And in the 40s, they had dropped evening services. And in the early 50s, he said, they had been the first to use the new red-covered RSV communist-inspired Bible. And thus, he said, this left no doubt about it that their story was old, not the same old story, for the word virgin in that modernist communist Bible had been replaced with young woman. And he said he had heard that the Methodists up in Hutchinson had no longer sang, "Lo, in the grave he lay," on Easter. Well, if theological homogeneity is important for our story oneness, it's important to our sociological homogeneity. Peter Wagner of Fuller Seminary is famous for teaching that churches grow by homogeneous units. Most of the time, the storyteller tells only sociological unit stories. Where did Jesus find the most abuse and non-acceptance? When he told stories with widened application. For instance, the parable of the son who is killed by the unfaithful vineyard keepers, or the story of the great banquet, which opened the Gentiles because the Jews were forbidden, who were invited to the feast, would not come. These are examples of stories that widen perspectives. Homogeneous communities like stories that are told for community and for whom the various elements of the stories fit everything. So while the anthem of the church may be, "Tell me the old, old story," middle-class suburbanites really sing, "Tell me the old, old middle-class suburban story." In my book, Fred and Irma, their old aunt has written them a letter and expresses the provincialism of our story. She says in this letter that she writes to them, "I know you must be doing well. I'm so excited. I have been made the Methodist representative on the Jesus Waxahachie Committee. It is such an honor," she said. "We are having a gospel quartet, a Christian jogger, a converted communist who rode his junk to freedom from Haiphong Harbor. Our steering committee is trying to get the gospel royals to sing. They're all Methodists, but real solid. In fact, the bishop said they are one group whose theology never gets in the way of their old-fashioned dedication to Jesus." Now, let me tell you about the main services at the stadium. The song leader is going to do a concert under the lights, singing songs from his latest album, Penthouse Hymns. And as a converted hooker is going to share her testimony, "Men I knew before I knew the man of Galilee." And then the greater Waxahachie All-Church Choir is going to sing. And if we get the gospel royals to sing, it should be a wonderful evening with hundreds of decisions, especially if they sing selections from their new album, Hot Grace. I just love that song. "I'm higher than I've ever been before since I heard him knocking at my door." You see, I'm afraid our spirit of revivalism has often championed a story, a tinsel and glitzy Jesus. We must see that the power of the pulpit guards against such stories or narrows people's concepts. What are we doing by picking a suburban Christ for suburbanites or a grenade-throwing Christ for liberation theologians? We are giving our particular kind of spiritual community a walled focus. We are blinding our world one eye at a time by ghettoizing. We are building provinces that keep our version of the story parochial. We must let his story grow wide until it does not parochialize, just as stories can provincialize, they may also globalize and awaken conscience. Christ ultimately hung upon a cross, I believe, because he globalized in a province. Since God is global, every call to preach is a call to see over the boundaries, whether they be denominational boundaries or ethnic boundaries or geography. Seeing widely is liberation. Once we have seen, we cannot go back to the province and see that our stories shoehorn slipper people into stingy narrowness. There is a world out there. And the great gift of every preacher-storyteller is to cause people to see widely. I have often said I would love Christ if for no other reason than he was able to take the non-too-cosmopolitan disciples and say, "Your comfortable Galilee is gone now. You are stewards of the world. Therefore, go. With all of your limitations, speaking with dull Aramaic accents, go to the crisp Latin ghettos of Rome and tell global truths. They are the ones which matter." And I do like thinking of Peter, the Galilean fisherman who finds himself captive to so great a story. He dies 2,000 miles from the Sea of Galilee, where a common carpenter taught him he was responsible for the world. Here is the paradox of world stories. They must be real within the province where they are told. They must tell with that kind of mind. You see, Peter learned in Galilee a word for the senators and slaves and told them from wide settings to tiny, cozy settings, where they had to be relational and intimate. But stories and sermons and relationships have one other thing in common. Stories mold and define communities, such as the Christian story. Our stories are told and retold and have a way of becoming very predictable. How does one tell the same old story every week without garnering the qualities of sameness? Well, we do it by keeping the story by telling the same old story and keeping it fresh and spontaneous. Now, charismatics have shown us, I believe, the relational power of happening, and the best stories appear as happening. I suggest that the early success of the charismatic movement, especially among high churches, is due to the heavy liturgy for centuries of Episcopal and Lutheran churches, for instance. And spontaneity builds relationship. Liturgy tends to isolate, often with high-sounding elitist walls of boredom. Pentecostals will crush you in coils of koinonia. But in a day of virile loneliness, their churches have exploded in size, proving that most of us would rather risk a little wildfire than no fire at all. And relationalism is happening in worship. It's Sunday Night Live. Heavy liturgy is elitist. It allows us to think well of ourselves. But spontaneity is the soil of the Spirit, making the cold ones warm. I spoke at the Interdenominational Missionary Conference in Costa Rica recently. The Baptist churches I visited often had miles of empty pews, with hymnals standing upright in the racks. But the charismatic churches were crowded, people touching each other with mariachis, tambourines, and maracas. And there was enthusiasm and warmth there. Several years ago, I spoke at one of our Southern Baptist College chapels, one of our universities in the South. The students made it very clear that they didn't want to be in chapel. They read newspapers and were otherwise obnoxious to me. I flew from there directly to Oral Roberts University, where 4,500 people came into chapel, cheering, clapping, sometimes holding their hands up, and maybe talking in tongues. But I don't have to tell you which of the two chapels meant the most to me. One of them spoke in warm terms of relationships. You see, story doesn't work without spontaneity. When my children said, "Daddy, make up a story," they were telling me that the spontaneous is important. The exciting things about stories happening is that they never get predictable. Snoopy well demonstrates there's no use trying to change from one story form of predictability to another. In one of his comic strips, Snoopy is shown on the doghouse typing a novel. He begins the story with the words, "It was a dark and stormy night." Snoopy always began his stories with, "It was a dark and stormy night." Lucy happened to come by and put in her 2 cents worth of advice. Her aggressive, blunt tone of voice, she says, "You stupid dog, that's the dumbest thing I ever read. Who ever heard of beginning a story? Don't you know that good stories begin once upon a time?" She berated him and belittled him and left. In the last frame of the strip, Snoopy started over, and he's typing this time, "Once upon a time, it was a dark and stormy night." In happening, it is the transcription that makes the story. You see, when story comes so spontaneous and wonderfully fast that you cannot write it down, it is a wondrous intrigue. Pooh testifies, "Poetry and hums aren't something which you get. They're something which get you. And all you can do is go where they are and let them find you." And he wrote this hum, "Help, help and rescue, and show the others where to go. Sing ho for Piglet ho." And soon the door was opened wide, and we were both outside. "Sing ho for Piglet ho." "So there it is," said Pooh. And when he had sung this to himself 3 times, "It came different from what I thought it would," he said. "But now it's come, and I'll go and sing it to Piglet." In the manner of their coming, which unrehearsed and unrehearsed, it gets formal sometimes in storytelling and demanding. We don't like stories that are hoity-toity. We like stories that are relational. And Pooh's last line intrigues me. "Now I must go and sing it to Piglet." Some years ago, I preached only manuscript sermons. Gradually, with pain, I came to realize that sermons must be prepared, but delivered with enough ease to convince the congregation that I was having a personal tete-a-tete with each of them alone. I changed my sermon style. Finally, the sermon as emotion in relationship. There are many, many ways to say this. Hemingway's description of the old man of the sea makes it very, very clear that he is not so much of introducing us to the old man as describing him, and in the description is the warmth. You see, emotion is the language of relationship. Small wonder when we are told then, the auditor will say, "How touching." It's interesting that he doesn't say "how audible" when he hears a great story, since stories should be more heard than touched. Yet touching is the word, and touching is the word of emotion. Ashley Montague in The Human Connection suggests those four distances that have become so famous: the public distance, the distance we enjoy with those who are 12 to 25 feet away from us, the social distance, which is 4 to 12 feet, the personal distance, which is 18 inches to 4 feet, and the intimate distance, which is 18 inches to 0 inches. You see, confessional preaching needs to happen in our lives because it is life-changing religion always happens within the last 18 intimate inches. In fact, when we sing, "Come into my heart," we're saying something what we believe about intimacy in conversion. The basic public distances may be all right for great lecture series, but the intimate distance is the touching distance. And confessional preaching moves the audience spatially towards you until finally your hearts indeed touch. I must confess, the only time I have listened to Jimmy Swaggart was 2 weeks ago when I heard he was going to confess. I had heard him earlier condemn Catholics, and I thought I would enjoy his confession more than his condemnation. I tuned in. It was amazing that as he confessed, I found that he closed the distance between Baton Rouge and Omaha, and I moved in closer and closer. Sorry, I couldn't get even closer to my television set. It was as though he were whispering his repentance in my ear. Talk about the intimate distance of confession. I experienced it. He asked me to forgive him, and I did forgive him right on the spot. And so must you forgive him, by the way. As our Father hath forgiven us, so we must forgive all who ask for it. We may not be able to restore his credibility, but all of us can practice the art of forgiveness. You see, Walt Whitman wrote, "When I heard the learned astronomer," he said, I heard the proofs and figures arranged in columns before me. But then I went out," he said, "and looked upward in silence and awe at the stars." You see, a storyteller reminds me of what an old deacon said. Lord, he always prayed, "Lord, hide our preacher behind the cross and let us see only Jesus." I have never felt the pulpit a very good place to be hidden. I feel exposed. I feel exhibitionist discovered in the pulpit. The best astronomers, however, Whitman is right, as the deacon is right. They don't read us papers. The best ones show us the stars. A storyteller tells us about dragons is not to be compared with a storyteller whose art erases himself until we feel the dragon breathing down our necks. I have, back in Oklahoma, heard any number of evangelists. One of them I heard as a child had a poster that read, 48 Hours in Hell. He had died of what I can't recall, perhaps poor homiletics. But before his grieving widow could collect her first annuity board check, he had been miraculously restored to life. I went to hear this living dead man, whose former rigor mortis had now come to inflict his sermons. And there was a certain flair in his return from hell. He now had a purple suit and a song leader's haircut. He had brought a big tent, and it was filled with light bulbs and candle flies and mosquitoes. And sitting there, sphincters downward on the hardwood planks, we listened to his sermon, 48 Hours in Hell. He drew long and lurid pictures of his death experience. It took him nearly as long to preach on hell as he had consumed in his visit. His brother, Evangelist B, claimed that he had raised Evangelist A from the dead. Why, I wondered. It could not have been in the interest of pulpit excellence. But on the other hand, here and there, among Oklahoma evangelists, I would hear an old parson preach. And he would sometimes move in a saucy defiance of grammar. But in spite of his polarity to Shakespeare, I found myself enthralled. And I would listen as the storyteller did seem to hide himself behind the cross. And his story danced in light. All churches at 11 on Sunday mornings are tribute to the relational power of story. For whatever congregational grudges there may be, it seems to me that while the story is being told, we move closer together. It is a language of emotional togetherness. Leo Buscaglia says that he went to see The Man of La Mancha. He was so moved at the finale that he began to weep. He couldn't help himself. A woman turned with a kind of concrete face to her husband beside her and said, "Look, honey, that man is crying." Having heard her, Buscaglia said, "I seized upon the moment. I stood to put on my own show for the dry-eyed woman." He said, in that moment, I cupped my hands over my face and wept loudly, boo-hooed in Hollywood brokenness. The woman sensed that her unemotional nature was being rebuked and even over-rebuked. But he said, clearly, it must have said to her, emotion is the stuff of life, and crying is not shame, but glory. Oh, I have wished that more of my sermons would end in that kind of togetherness where it intersects the life of those who hear me, and perhaps they weep at last to make God their friend. But at least they can say, make us one. Circumstance and the world will do all it can to separate us and divide us into little people. But in the meantime, God, make us one. Fold us to togetherness and teach us that we are more alike than we thought we were before the story started.